You're listening to Section D, first broadcast on the 1st of December 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm your host, Henry Rhys Sheridan, standing in again this week for Josh Fennett. On today's show, we turn our attention to interiors. To begin with, we check out a new museum dedicated to the Italian furniture company Molteni.
We don't export furniture, we export an idea of house. We export a way of life.
Next, we speak to Tara Bernard, one of Britain's most renowned interior design talents. Then, I pay a visit to London's Royal College of Art to chat with Graham Brooker, head of the interior design programme there, to find out what he's doing to foster the next generation of interior design greats.
How does the interior actually make people use space in a very, very different way? We like to have students to think very deeply about what inside space means.
And finally, we sit down with a Kuwaiti designer, Jassim Al-Sadar, to discuss Diwania, traditional entertainment spaces that designers are rethinking and remaking. All that to look forward to today on Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. Italian design can sometimes seem to be all about Milan, which grabs the headlines as buyers and press look for the latest standout pieces in the city's showrooms. But it's in the nearby region of Brianza that the country's furniture industry keeps busy. Home to many top firms, the area has become synonymous with Italian interior design. One prominent player is family-run company Molteni, who have spent 80 years manufacturing finely crafted components for the home. To celebrate their know-how and longevity in a field subject to fickle trends and changing tastes, the company has recently unveiled a new corporate museum to show off the workmanship and creativity that has kept them a step ahead. We dispatched Monocle's Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho, to the museum's inauguration, where he caught up with Carlo Molteni, head of the Molteni Group, and famed industrial designer Jasper Morrison, who was behind the museum's design.
Two photographs illustrate how it all began.
The town of Giussano may not have the name recognition of Milan, but for fans of Italian design, the best way to understand how the industry rose to become a world leader requires a visit to this unassuming town. Since 1934, family-run furniture brand Molteni has called Giussano home and has worked with the leading lights in industrial design, from Aldo Rossi to Jean Nouvel. Now with an eye to its heritage, the company has converted one of its factory buildings into a permanent exhibit with products, prototypes, and videos to showcase its role in promoting top-quality furniture over the decades.
The 60s. After the machine revolution, the style challenge. Manufacturers joined forces to attract the world to Milan. And Angelo Molteni was among the 14 founders of the first Salone del Mobile, 1961. Modern furniture made its debut.
Museum visitors are greeted by a series of simple, sleek white stands devised by designer Jasper Morrison to display key pieces, many of them crafted in wood, like the mop bookshelf by Afra and Tobias Scarpa from the 70s. There's modular office furniture done in the late 60s for IBM, to the 1990s super slim Les table in stainless steel by Jean Nouvel. It's a rich design legacy on display, a legacy rooted in the Brianza region. Molteni president, Carlo Molteni.
We have not only the idea of presenting with this museum the history of 8 years of activity of the company, but more than that, we have the idea to represent also an area and the story of the design in Italy, because in fact here around there are a few other companies that start like Cassina before of us, Cappellini together with us and others, that at the end is the real story of the Italian design, starting from a so limited area, because if you put together Cassina, B&B, Cappellini, Molteni and few others, there is a circle of 20 kilometers. And this is an interesting story, because outside of this area there was only follower that comes later on. We don't export furniture, we export a way of life, let's say, a way of putting together the things with a certain way and to have a complete look of the house, not only furniture. We not export chair or sofa or whatever. We export an idea of house. And this is really what it happens, let's say, because many times we are requested, when also we sell only kitchen and wardrobe, when they do the marketing suite, they want our idea of still life, or of way of life.
Now, the reason to have museum space here where the factory is and not, say, for example, in Milan?
First of all, because this is our starting point, where my father started and I started years ago. And so we are proud to be here and not to be in a normal attitude of Milano. Second is a place where we continue to be. Let's say this is a museum of our enterprise. It's a memory of our story. And so to be in to a real museum, it will be not useful. We have a program with Jasper to see every year what we have to change and what we have to invent, to present.
Given the opportunity to explore Molteni's archive of thousands of sketches, prototypes, and finished products, curator Jasper Morrison assembled a collection he believes best shows the skill and working culture of the Brianza region by way of the output of one of the area's most successful brands.
Well, I think one of the nicest aspects of the museum are the prototypes. It's always fascinating to see other designers' prototypes. And even more fascinating when they're as old as this. So this, like this Werner Blaser chest of drawers from 1955, I think, which was maybe one of the first products they considered, but they never made. But it's such a beautiful piece. And then for me personally, it was fascinating to discover Luca Meda, the designer, who I knew about vaguely, but just to see more of his work. I think he was a great designer. I've been working here in Brianza since probably 88, starting with Capellini, but then with others too. Discovering this network of small workshops that can not only do anything, but also the impossible. One of the other great pieces in the exhibition is a prototype of a chair for Aldo Rossi's theatre in Genova, Carlo Felice, which he designed with Luca Meda in 1990. And the prototype itself is just an amazing example of Brianzolo craftsmanship, bits of wood with shapes that you never will imagine wood could take on. I mean, I've never come across anywhere else in the world. In Japan, of course, they can make things beautifully, but in Brianza, there's a kind of ability to discuss something in the morning, go for lunch and come back after lunch and find it prototyped, and not just prototyped how you thought, but with other suggestions from the craftsmen. It's an unbelievable resource.
That was Ivan Carvalho, Monocle's man in Milan, visiting the Molteni Museum in Brianza, Italy. Quality furnishings are all well and good, but it's not enough to just fill a room with them. To create a truly special interior, you need a holistic vision about its potential and the know-how to execute it. This is what British designer Tara Bernard has mastered and realised in her work with restaurants, hotels and other spaces. She sat down with Monocle editor Josh Fennett to discuss her work and her approach to interiors.
So among your many projects that you're undertaking at the minute, Tara, I'd like to talk, first of all, about the Hotel Russell. And I'd like to talk about it because, you know, it's a beautiful hotel. It's Edwardian. It's got that lovely terracotta tiling. But you've been put in charge of actually making it a place where people sort of want to stay at the minute for Starwood Hotels. Can you tell me a little bit about what we can expect from your work and when all this is going to happen?
I'm sure you chose that because it's the most challenging. It's an extraordinary legacy, in a sense, that sits there presiding over Russell Square. We were brought in to take the role as lead interior architects and designers. She is quite a beast. I mean, there are 400 rooms, which we've taken down to about 330 now, just to make some of the rooms larger. We're responsible for lobbies and lounge bars, But what's fascinating is what it used to be like. And I had lunch with someone the other day who used to be a waiter many, many years ago, and they used to have dancers there. And apparently what we are rechristening and bringing back to life, the Palm Court, which takes a sort of the core centre of the ground floor, was one of the most popular places. And I think you sort of are a little bit like a custodian. It's not just the design and your name and what we do and Starwoods. Actually, I feel a responsibility to bring this place back to life.
And it's an old grand dame of the hotel, and I don't know if you know this piece of trivia, but the person, the architect who designed it in 1898, was also responsible for the dining room of the Titanic, although that was an ill-fated mission.
I can't believe you just
there was an extraordinary amount of grandeur, and it's very much of that kind of that sort of decadent age. So I wonder what the challenges are to updating it and making it, you know, suitable for people that are going to stay there today.
Well, you're spot on about the interiors. Well, first of all, they're challenged for the very fact that they're listed. And any building that is listed, it gets complicated. We have to marry together the sort of modern world that we live in. What is current is terribly important for when building any hotel. What is the lifestyle today? What do we need? What are our guests demanding? And at the same time, give respect to its history, both for the planning side, but also, for example, as we walk in just aesthetically, the marble cladding is something else. And you can't change it. You can imagine a palette, if you can try, of orange, green, crimson reds and yellows in marble. And we embrace that.
And Tara, you've become something of a darling of the hotel groups looking to revive the interiors. You know, in our pre-interview chat, we talked about the Four Seasons, we talked about the Intercontinental Group. These are monumental kind of hotel chains. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about your work, what you're doing for them, and why you think they approached you, if that's not too awkward a question to ask.
No, it's a topic that fascinates me, and I've focused on sort of lifestyle and hotels for many years now. So it was a welcomed call when we first heard from sort of the bigger players. And I don't want to say they're bigger, they're just talking about Grand Dames and the Russell. These are the kings of the business. When Four Seasons first got in touch with us, I would not necessarily have put us in association to them. And I think one of the most poignant parts of what you're asking is answered in the fact that design has shifted. What people want has shifted massively. So the original guest, the original Four Seasons customer, or indeed Rosewood or Intercontinental, people we're speaking to, it's nature. It's not an impolitical thing to say that life's moved on, and maybe those people in their 30s, 40s and 50s are in their 70s and age has moved on, and they need to adapt to what their 30s and 40s are. And I have got enough years under my belt, I guess, to reflect what is current for those age groups, what they're looking for. And there is a change in what people demand of in hotels, and the big, big brands have to face it. And they want to, because why shouldn't they stay being the leaders of their industries? We see it in the smaller boutiques because they have to compete with that. That's what they've got. But the operational skills and the scale of these big players is extraordinary, and it's the most fascinating and very privileged time to be working with them all.
And the poignant question for me is, as we see the emergence of these smaller hotel chains, and we see this kind of interesting dynamic, as you said, developing, you know, the larger chains are no longer able to exclusively corner the market. You have your André Bellage right here just down the road in Marylebone with the Chiltern Firehouse. You have the Ferndale Hotel Group. The Ham Yard Hotel has been an extraordinary success since it opened, I think, last year. Mm. How can, you know, what are the tangible ways in which these big hotel groups can change their offerings and, you know, reignite that kind of passion for staying in these hotels, and how are you going to go about facing that problem head on?
It's a very multifaceted question, and indeed the answers to it are layered, as in the response of what you need to do is layered. It's true, some of these hotels are just gems, the twinkling of Chiltern Firehouse down the road, and André's yet again exceptional attention to detail. And if we can affect that warmth and that atmosphere back within, and I don't want to say within Four Seasons, because Four Seasons is very, very usually always get it right. But some of the larger groups who aren't necessarily getting it wrong, but are perhaps challenged by the need and demand of change, if they can embrace as well and encapsulate what those smaller boutiques are doing, plus have all the know-how, the service, the scale. I mean, Intercontinental have come to me to look at them as a whole, to consider where they sit today in terms of 190 hotels globally. It's a lot of hotels. Some of those hotels average at about 500 rooms. So the scale of those operations versus 24 bedrooms at Chiltern Firehouse and getting everyone as beautiful as everybody looks at is a much bigger challenge. And I like big challenges.
That was Monocle's Josh Fennett chatting to British designer Tara Bernard. Still to come on the show, we talk interiors and design in Kuwait and take a look at how the next generation of interior designers are learning their craft. Do keep listening.
How do you write a biography? Are we all curators today? Who still makes fanzines? And how close are fact and fiction? These are some of the questions constantly puzzling us here at Monocle. So each week on our culture show, we spin the globe to find the very best writers, musicians, artists, gallerists, filmmakers, commentators, and even mudlarks to debunk these cultural mysteries. Tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, every Monday at 1900 UK time, where all will be revealed.
Of course, excellent interior design relies on excellent interior designers. London's Royal College of Art is doing us all a favour by working to make the next generation of interior design thinkers and doers the best they can be. Earlier in the week, I paid a visit to Graham Brooker, head of the interior design programme at the RCA, to discuss how.
We are very keen to develop students in a way which first and foremost makes them independent and critically independent. And what I mean by that is that they are clever enough and sophisticated enough to understand a wide variety of different problems, but apply unusual and different ways of thinking about how to solve those problems, let's say. We are very keen to develop students which allows them to become socially engaged. There's a lot of people who think about the interior as a kind of luxury object that's kind of maybe frivolous or always looks beautiful or perfect and beyond that doesn't do much else. Our students, we like them to think about the interior with a social dimension. And what I mean by that is, how can it change people's lives? How can it make them feel better? How economically might it change cities? Because it can do that as a kind of economic instrument. How does the interior actually make people use space in a very, very different way? And all these things are very, very important for us. We get beyond the surface of the interior. We like to have students to think very deeply about what inside space means.
Explain to me how interior design can function as an instrument of economic change.
Well, let's just take the word function first and foremost. Function is a word which quite often relates to a kind of discourse in architecture, which is very historically focused, primarily around form and function. Now, in interiors, we tend to use existing buildings and spaces a lot. Whether it's a line on a page or whether it's an existing building, we will be asked to or purpose to give a new interior to a space. Economically, that is already quite a significant statement, because what we're saying is, rather than knocking down a building and starting again, which has all kinds of implications in terms of sustainability, our climate, etc., we're saying, take that existing building, it might have been used for something completely different, but let's make it into something else. And that is already an economic statement, a growing economic statement about interiors.
Maybe you can take me through some of your favourite examples of successful executions of that kind of thing in recent years.
The most successful example of repurposing an existing building is Tate Modern. An old power station that was derelict for many, many years now is, I don't know the exact figures, but now is one of the foremost tourist attractions in London. And so therefore, if you think economically, that was once a redundant building with no use, it's gone beyond its function. It becomes occupied for an art gallery, which becomes a cultural centre. And as you can see, through good interior work, which is what that is, the whole of that area of London is now being regenerated. So for me, that's probably beyond issues of style and aesthetic. You know, I'm not bothered about that in many ways. But the whole economic regeneration of that area is down to the repurposing of an existing building.
Talking about spiralling visitor numbers, property prices in London and indeed in many other cities around the world are going through the roof at the moment. There's a huge amount of visitors coming to cities and people are having to adjust their expectations about what an accommodating room looks like and feels like. Do you want to take me through some trends that you've noticed with regards to this in recent years? You know, how are people's expectations of what accommodating interior design is are changing?
The design of the interior, and particularly the design of the room, for me, is at the forefront of economic change and social change. We all live in rooms, we all exist in rooms, whether they're big spaces, small spaces, etc. So how we start to live in them is crucial. Now, London, because of its kind of rise in property values, etc., we have to rethink the room and we have to rethink about how we live together. For me, an interesting kind of development in the last few years is the notion of multi-generational living. No longer can we have, or understand anyway, the nuclear family, let's say, two parents, two kids. Now we have to think about the fact that our children cannot move on, they cannot afford to rent, they cannot move out of the family home. Rather than being a problem, let's think about how the interior can respond to that with regards to different generations living in different domestic spaces. How do we all live together? And how does that impact upon the interior and the room?
And finally, technology is driving huge change in almost every field of human endeavor. How is it impacting on interior design?
I think technology essentially is leading to spaces which are almost collapsing before our eyes. And what I mean by that is I commute to work. My office can be a train. My office can be my phone as well as my laptop. People who drive, that becomes their offices. So technology is almost collapsing the traditional notions of what is distinctive inside, outside space, personal space and private space as well. For me, I think that's a really interesting situation. I think there's also a response to that, which is about developing your own personal space to the point of where it becomes quite bespoke and you still feel like you're inhabiting your own room or your own area, even though you might be somewhere very public. So this distinction between public and private, this distinction between your own personal space and somebody else's, is at the moment a real challenge in interiors. It's eroding to the point of where some people are feeling uncomfortable, but also at the same time it's developed in a way where people can start to almost customize what they wear, how they operate in a public space, how they utilize technology to create their own domestic environment. And I think that's the real challenge.
That was me talking to Graham Brooker, head of the Interior Design Programme at the Royal College of Art. The diversity of interior spaces around the world reflects the eclectic cultural requirements of different societies. Diwania are mixed-use hosting and entertainment spaces that play a hugely important role in Kuwait and other Gulf states, but are largely unknown outside of the region. Last week, Monocle's Fernando Pacheco sat down with Jassim Al-Sadar, creative manager and owner of Kuwaiti design studio Bab Nim Nim, to discuss the unique interior design requirements of these spaces, their evolution through time, and the design scene in Kuwait.
Originally, it was a meeting place for the politics of the area, if they want to like discuss it between themselves, or let's say for different like religious ceremonies that they have back home, and also for for eating or for whatever it may be. And then it turned into almost, let's say, a show off of the wealth that you have. Of course, your position within society, and it has interchanged throughout the years, and now it's almost like pretty much a pleasure palace.
And what's the style of those places? I just want to know more in terms of design, the interiors perhaps.
It's usually like a huge U, not as in building type, as in a huge space that is a gathering space. Within a Diwania, it has to follow this continuous seat, so that when people come in, they usually greet towards the right, and then they continue greeting towards the left. So it's pretty much like a queue of greeting. And after they sit down, they would also greet again, because if they missed somebody who actually came in and sat down, to greet whoever they missed. So it's kind of an interesting sense that they have to like sit in front of each other, because it's always about the conversation. And of course, there's always like tea being served, some little sweets and whatever. Now, of course, they do them as family duanias, where, like, for instance, a very prominent family from a certain part of the society, they would actually invest all of them into building a huge duania where they would do, you know, the weddings and, let's say, I don't know, for funeral reasons, because funerals are also a huge gathering. So it really depends on the family themselves and what the requirements are.
And I want to ask a question more in general about Kuwait. I mean, do you think there's been some sort of resurgence in terms of Kuwait architecture and the art scene as well in the country? Because, you know, in the region, we hear a lot about Dubai, for example. And you know, sometimes Kuwait can be a bit forgotten. But do you think it's changing this?
It is changing, I have to say. And the younger crowds are actually pushing it forward in that sense. Especially from a younger generation of mine. I mean, I'm 33 now, so from a younger generation, they are really pushing it forward and giving Kuwait some sort of a presence within the art scene, let's say, or even within the food scene. Strangely enough, a lot of the people within the region, like, let's say, Saudis, Emiratis, Qataris, Omanis, they come and visit Kuwait because they actually do think that we are the trendsetters, be it in fashion, be it in architecture, be it in whatever dealing with art and design, because we have a stronger input from the citizens themselves, the Kuwaitis. Whereas, let's say, in Dubai and, let's say, in Qatar, it's usually an influence of foreigners, not really an influence of the Emiratis themselves or the Qataris themselves.
Justin, now moving on, I want to know more about your practice. When did you found your
yes,
office? Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Coming to that. I founded my company in September 2010. And the name of my company is Bab Nimnim, which actually translates to small detailed door in Arabic. Of course, the name was due to the fact that I strongly believe that the door is the threshold that, of course, humans can penetrate between the interior and the exterior. And it's the only threshold that is penetrable, obviously. So we do like dealing with that whole idea of the continuity of the exterior to the interior and the interior continuing to the exterior. And also at the same time, we're very detail-oriented within our office. And I hope it actually shows within our work.
Finally, I want to know about your latest projects. I know we discussed a little bit before the interview about a restaurant.
Yes.
Am I open early next year? Can you? Or?
Well, it's in its very, very, very final stages. It's a project that we're extremely, extremely proud of. We've been working on it at Bab Nimnim for the past 4.5, or actually almost 5 years, but 4.5 years to be exact. The name of the restaurant is Dar Hamed, and it is based on Kuwaiti cuisine, but it's been reinterpreted in some sort of a modern way. The building from the outside represents a dowry box that's usually presented to a bride in Kuwait, which is called Sanduk Mubayyat, which actually means box that is adorned with little studs. So from the outside, you could actually see almost like, let's say, a literal presentation of it, or illustration, let's say. And from the inside, there are different remnants of the golden era of Kuwait, which was in the 50s and 60s. Kuwait was on the cover of Life magazine on 1957 as the modern place to be, strangely enough. So it's got like different remnants or references from the 50s and 60s up to the 70s.
That was Monocle's Fernando Pacheco talking to Jassim Al-Sadar from Kuwaiti design studio Bab Nimnim. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to my co-producer Ben Ryland and editor Alex Funnell. If you have any comments or queries, please feel free to drop me a note at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at the same time. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Sheridan, and until next time, it's goodbye from me.